Welcome to the first live Political Rewind of 2018. I'm Bill Nigut, and I want to wish all of you out there who listen to this show as regularly and devotedly as you do a very, very happy 2018. I hope it's a fulfilling year for every single one of us. With us in the studio on this first show of the new year, we have Eric Tannenblatt. He is a Republican. I do think calling you a Republican strategist is appropriate. You're also one of the biggest fundraisers for Republican candidates in the Southeast at all levels of government. Fair enough way. And you're the head of the government affairs practice for the world's largest law firm, Denton's. Yeah? Is that a fair, you know, we should start the new year with the kind of introduction you all want.
Largest and leading.
Okay. Welcome. We're going to get into a really interesting conversation with you later, Eric, because Mitt Romney is someone you have supported, done a lot of work for, know very, very well.
Good man.
And later in the show, we'll talk about the likelihood that he is now going to run for the United States Senate, now that Orrin Hatch has said he is definitely retiring from his seat in Utah. Also joining us, Beth Shapiro. Beth Shapiro worked as a Democratic consultant and pollster. Also did a lot of polling work for corporate and nonprofit partners in the Southeast during her career. She remains as active as she did when she was working in a full-time position, still involved in politics, and still, I think, fair to say, Beth Shapiro, pulling for the Democrats.
You know, I was born with that defective gene. I have been pulling for the Democrats since I was a child, and I will be pulling for them until I breathe my last breath.
Well, we're really glad to have you here. And also joining us today, Republican consultant Todd Rehm. He is also the editor of GeorgiaPundit.com, which you can get every day and which I've said often on this show, is really worth your looking at because Todd not only deals with the big national stories, but he really drills down beyond state politics to municipal politics. I learn more about what's going on at the local level on Georgia Pundit than anywhere else that I look each day. And people can subscribe to your newsletter.
Absolutely. It's free, and it goes out every weekday.
How do they do that?
You go to GeorgiaPundit.com, GAPundit.com, and sign up in the right-hand sidebar.
Okay. Before we get into our political talk, two things that I want to deal with. First, I want to give you an important programming note. For those of you who have been regular listeners to this show, you know that we've had sort of an odd schedule. We're on the air on Mondays and Wednesdays at 2 o'clock, and we're on the air on Fridays at 3 o'clock. Well, we've decided, it may not be confusing for you, but we can never figure out what time we're on any given day. So to make our lives easier, if not yours, starting a week from Friday, starting on January 12th, Political Rewind will move to 2 o'clock so that you can find us at 2 p.m. on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, and we hope that change works for you. We're pleased to get a little continuity. So join us at 2 on Friday, starting next Friday, January 12th. All right, again, before we talk politics, there's a weather event going on down on the Georgia coast. More than apparently an inch or so of snow in the Savannah area, also in Effingham County. The roadways are icy. People are being advised to stay off the street for at least a while. The Savannah Hilton Head Airport, International Airport, was shut down. That may still be the case. I'm not quite sure. And the governor's declared a state of emergency in 28 counties down along the coast. Emily Jones of our Savannah Bureau is riding out the storm down there. And Emily, we're thrilled you could spend just a couple minutes. Set the stage for us. What's it like down there right now?
To be perfectly honest, it's just kind of weird. It never snows here. It truly never snows in Savannah. So, you know, I'm looking out my window right now and watching snowflakes fall from the sky, and it's really the first time that I've seen this in the 4 years I've been here. And that's kind of the reaction I'm seeing from both friends and strangers all over social media as well, as everybody is kind of just like, oh my goodness, it is snowing. There are icicles on my overhang, and there are icicles on the fountain in Forsyth Park. There is snow all over Savannah's, you know, famous squares and all over our palm trees. It's a very strange sight, and a lot of people are headed out just kind of checking out this weird, you know, very, very rare event.
I think the last time you had a measurable snow in Savannah was about 7 years ago, something like that?
Yeah, that's what I've been able to find. Like I said, I've been here about 4 years, and we've had a couple flurries, but we really haven't had snowfall. The last, you know, media reports I can find of snowfall were in 2010, and at the time, in 2010, the AP reported that was the first snowfall in 14 years in Savannah. So it's, you know, it's a once a decade or more kind of a thing to see this sort of actual snow really sticking and you know, blanketing the whole city in this layer of snow.
So everything is shut down. How have city officials, city government responded? How about the state emergency management folks? They're clearly alerted. They're very involved in this. Have things seemed to go well from that end?
So far as we can tell, you know, unlike the emergencies, weather emergencies that we are, I hate to say used to, but what we normally see here on the coast is an event like a hurricane or flooding events, that kind of thing, you know. And obviously we've had a couple of those in the last few years, and there's a lot to coordinate. There's evacuations and all of that kind of thing. Pretty much since yesterday afternoon-ish, we've, you know, started hearing from both local and state folks. You know, the governor declared the state of emergency, and mostly the word, as you said, has just been stay inside.
Right, right.
Charge your phones and buy plenty of food and just stay in your house, is what they're saying.
Well, Emily, I hope you get a chance to get out and try to make your first Savannah snowman. Is the snow sticking? Is it? Can you make snowballs out of it, I hope?
It is sticking, and it's sort of a wet snow. It was mixed with ice earlier on, and certainly we're on the coast, so we're used to humidity. So wet snow, in my experience of snow, I'm from the north, so
yeah, you can handle it.
Well, wet snow is usually good for a snowball.
Emily, thank you so much for joining us. Stay safe and warm down there, and we send our best to all of the folks in Savannah and the coastal area as you deal with this emergency. Take care of yourself.
Thank you, Bill.
All right. So we've got a lot to talk about in political news. I want to start and throw it out to all of you. A big story, really, in Washington today. We have two brand new United States senators sworn in today. Today's a day that Democrat Doug Jones was sworn in as the U.S. Senator from Alabama, replacing Jeff Sessions, of course, who became Attorney General, fought in one of the most controversial races that we've seen in the country in years. But he was sworn in, and so was Democrat Tina Smith, who replaces Al Franken as the new senator from Minnesota. Beth, one interesting thing about Tina Smith, it was surprising to me when I read that she brings the total of women in the United States Senate to 22. That's a fairly healthy number, although women's representation in Congress remains still very, very low by percentage.
It's a problem that many of us have been trying to address for decades now, and that I expect we'll be continuing to address over the years to come. But I do think that at least in terms of the U.S. Senate, that the movement is in the right direction, that the numbers are increasing. I think what's important to note about the number of women in any legislative body or the presence of women in any legislative body is that they do change it. And I think for the better, we've certainly seen that in the U.S. Senate, where there has been much more conversation, much more collaboration between women of opposing parties than in general there has been between men of opposing parties, that women have been more likely to try to work together to find solutions. So I think that from a policy and a process standpoint, it's very good for us to have more women in legislative and in elected office, period.
I agree with you. And I should note, too, that on the Republican side in this upcoming election cycle, there are three women, Marsha Blackburn running for the Senate in Tennessee.
Yep.
Leah Volkmer, who's a state senator in Wisconsin, running in that Senate race. And then Martha McSally is likely going to announce, Congressman McSally in Arizona, So those are three potential Republicans.
You know, I think, Todd, there's another interesting aspect to this. The fact that we have 22 women in the United States Senate, and another, the 22nd being sworn in today, may also have a bearing on the other Senate seat that was filled today, that of the seat to replace Al Franken. It was women in the Senate, Democratic women, who began leading the call for Franken to step down, saying that it was no longer appropriate for him to serve after charges of sexual harassment came out.
And I agree with both Eric and Beth that they do, that women in office bring a lot to the table in terms of expanding the conversation and expanding the viewpoints. We have not yet seen in Georgia a great expansion of the number of women running for office. But I read an AP story this morning that says that nationwide we're seeing a lot more women running for office. And if it took the sexual misconduct stories that we're subjected to daily to start to kind of help kick that off, I think ultimately it'll be better for the country.
I think we have seen what I hope is the leading edge of the increased number of women in the legislature just from the special election results. Back last year, we have
one new member of the Senate, at least.
Two new members of the Senate. Yeah. One of which is a Democrat who won a previously Republican seat, and at least one new member of the House, Deborah Gonzalez from Athens. So we're already seeing an increase here, and there are literally women coming out of the woodwork running at least on the Democratic side, and I expect that we'll see an influx of women running on the Republican side as well.
And in fact, Emily's List, which has been around for a long time, that's helped to elect Democratic women, actually is going to see that they have some competition. There's a new organization called Winning for Women that is Republican-focused. They were very supportive of Karen Handel and her race in the special election for Congress. The three women I just noted that are running for the U.S. Senate will likely see support from that group, and they're out there actively recruiting women.
Of course, the other thing that happened today was that Democrats picked up one seat in the U.S. Senate. The Franken seat had been a Democratic seat, but the Alabama seat was held by a Republican. There's now a 51-49 split. The Republican margin grows even narrower. And a little later in the show, we'll talk about what impact that might have on some of the big legislative issues they're going to be taking up in Congress in the early part of 2018. But let's turn, if we can, to what's happening. The Georgia legislature begins its session on Monday, which is the same day that we're going to see the big case on the water wars, right? The court case on the Florida-Georgia water wars comes up, I believe, on Monday.
And there's another war the next day between Georgia and Alabama.
Well, it's that night. That night. And we're going to talk about that in a minute because it's had an impact on the legislative scheduling, apparently. But let's talk about a couple of the issues that we think are going to play a big role in this session. I'm fascinated by the fact, Todd, that we talked just a minute ago about women in the legislature. Because it's a young Georgia female legislator from North Fulton County, Megan Hansen.
DeKalb County.
North DeKalb County.
Thank you.
She's actually my representative.
She's Brookhaven. Thank you. She's held a news conference today to talk about a new Georgia hate crimes statute. Why is hate crimes, do you think? What does that mean, Todd?
So I actually spoke to her about that last night so that I would have something to say today. And what she did is she said that she was surprised to find out that Georgia doesn't have a penalty enhancement. And that's what it is. It's a penalty enhancement for other types of crimes. And she was surprised that it doesn't. We're one of five states that lack that in state law. And she sort of went back and looked at the history of it from the passage in 2000 of a hate crimes bill that was found unconstitutional by the state Supreme Court, and looked at it from, why don't we just adopt the federal essentially the federal legislation, the protected classes and all that kind of stuff. But I think it's in that particular case, I would say it's more of a difference. The difference in her perspective on that issue comes from two things, and not necessarily from the fact that she's female, but that she represents one of three or four of the most moderate Republican districts in the state, probably one of three or four of the state house districts with the largest Jewish populations. And I think it's a generational difference. She wasn't there in the early 2000s to see the fight under Democratic control over it, and sort of came to it with a different perspective of, you mean we don't already have that?
To give it a little background, and Beth and Eric, please weigh in. The Georgia Supreme Court struck down the hate crimes bill that was passed here back around 2000, I think.
It was passed in 2000 and struck down about 2004.
Yeah, and they did it because it was written, the court decided it was too vaguely written. You couldn't identify who was the victim of a hate crime. There were no what we call, I think, in law, enumerated classes.
Protected classes.
And the reason for that was because the legislature would not at that time have passed anything that started to enumerate classes of people against whom a hate crime could be promulgated.
People like people
race,
based on race,
sexual orientation,
religion,
gender.
And that, Eric Tanenblatt, has been the stumbling block for all those years since. The legislature, on a number of occasions, leaders in the legislature, be they Democrat or Republican over those years, have suggested they might be willing to accept a hate crime statute, but they could not draw the votes they needed to codify in law protections for the LGBTQ community, feeling they did not want, in a sort of an antiquated approach, to give them the force of law as a group.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. It's not in statute. It's not in statute in state statute for state employees. I mean, that's been an issue. It's come up in the recent religious liberties debate.
And I think that's one of the pitfalls we want to watch for, is this comes very close to the same territory as the religious liberty debate. And I think there's going to be some opportunities for cross-pollination on that issue.
Both for it, both good and bad.
Yes.
So, but have the times changed, Beth? Are we now at gay marriage is now legal? The polling here by the AJC and other organizations show a much more favorable climate of people's opinions about the LGBT community. Maybe the time has arrived that the legislature will be able to act on this.
Attitudes and behaviors and certainly have changed for the better. In general, but there still is a very intensely focused opposition to LGBT rights. I think the marriage ruling by the Supreme Court only served to harden some of that opposition, and so I think that we're going to be on some rough territory over the next few years in terms of fighting off religious freedom laws, passing hate crimes legislation, even though it's the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, that's taking the lead on this. I think we've got some rough territory that we're going to go
through. By the way, to explain, you're saying that explains what Todd meant when he talked about Brookhaven having heavy concentration of Jewish voters, ADL being a Jewish civil rights organization.
And that district used to take in Mary Hills, which I think probably would have made it the largest population of the district. But What I wonder is, if we were in a less polarized political time, which of course we're not, if this would open the door to a compromise where you take two federal statutes, the religious liberty and this one, because a lot of the objection to the religious liberty was that there was no anti-discrimination language or something like that. Is this enough anti-discrimination language to make the religious liberty?
No, because the religious liberty bills that have been proposed would wipe out the local anti-discrimination statutes that have been passed in Georgia cities, Atlanta's in particular. And so unless there's the hate crimes is important, but discrimination is equally, if in some cases not more important.
But there was a bill pending, and it may still be pending, that Rich Golick introduced to create a state civil rights statute.
Yeah.
And again, another in-town Republican, and then you have Megan Hansen, a Republican. So I think we're getting close.
All right. Finish that sentence, because then I got to get a break in.
Go ahead. I'm finished.
Thank you, Mr. Tannenblatt. So let's do that. Thanks to Eric Tannenblatt's graciousness to yield the floor. This is Political Rewind. We'll be back.
I'm Tanya Ott with a message from the Georgia Emergency Management Agency. Residents of the 28 coastal counties under a state of emergency are urged to stay off roadways during this winter storm. GDOT is working to keep roadways brined and cleared, but temperatures are expected to remain below freezing until Saturday, so residents should monitor updates from local officials and limit travel as some roads and bridges may be closed. Dial 511 or visit 511ga.org for roadway information and to report hazardous conditions.
Bev Shapiro, Todd Ream, Eric Tannenblatt with me in the Political Rewind studio today. Let's just tick off a couple of other issues that we know are going to be a big deal in the session starting on Monday down at the Capitol. We're going to see there's going to be a pairing, Eric Tannenblatt. On one hand, it appears that legislators are going to get serious, probably for the first time in a truly major way, about finding a way to fund at least capital projects that will expand transit in Metro Atlanta. And as a corollary, to make sure they balance all of this, legislature has just gotten a report, which it will now work to act on some provisions of, to bring relief to rural Georgia, high-speed internet, help for increasing the population, the possibility of economic development. The two are going to run in tandem as a way to please everybody in the state.
Yeah, and who would have thought, 10 years ago that we would be talking about trying to come up with a transit solution like they're talking about? And I think the rural economic development is so critical for the state. The fact that there are parts of the state that don't have broadband capabilities right now is just startling. Because, here in metropolitan Atlanta, it's just a given. And, I mean, just imagine if we didn't have that. And, I'm a big advocate, thinking ahead to the future and autonomous vehicles. And all of that requires broadband capabilities. And you need to have the ability for Wi-Fi. And so I think that, we need to be looking at ways in which we could enhance technology all across the state.
I'm not trying to throw cold water on the idea, but a lot of these proposals require large amounts of money.
Well, that was my first question. Where is it coming from?
And the bigger problem, I think, is that with this federal tax reform that passed in the last 2 weeks, that's going to change the amount of state revenue through the income tax, because so much of Georgia's income tax is tied to the federal code. And that's half of our revenue. And so we're going to see, I think, an increase in uncertainty over what state revenue is going to look like. And where do you find additional funds on top of whatever we may or may not need to cover once federal...
So you're talking about the money required for both the rural and the urban projects.
But either of them, we are talking about hundreds of millions or billions of dollars.
Yeah, that's what I mean. You're talking about both.
On top of a state budget that could take a hit from the 50% that comes through the federal government.
But I agree, but it seems like now we're in a period of we'll find the money later. Let's pass big projects and then we'll find out. We'll figure out how to fund them at some point in the future. So to come back to the whole notion of transit, I think that there are two drivers, no pun intended, or yes, actually pun intended, of that. One being Amazon and this big the spotlight on every state, every city that's going after that, and the need to be able to move people around so that we can continue to be in the running for developments like Amazon and for other major relocations. The other is that folks up in Alpharetta, up in the northern part of Fulton County in particular, they look at what's happening around Perimeter Center. They look at what's happening in Midtown, where you've got major relocations of major corporate players because their employees want to have access to rapid transit, and so I think that finally the leadership in some of the suburban areas has caught up with their people. I've seen polling for years that has shown that people in Cobb and North Fulton want additional transit options. But the leadership was recalcitrant
to look at the Amazon proposal. There's not a suggested location in Cobb County because of the transit piece.
Let me just jump in, and Eric,
nothing focuses the mind like fear of being left out of something like Amazon.
Let me throw this in, because Todd, let's pick up on Todd's point about funding, because we do need to point out that there are going to be county efforts to find transit money. Gwinnett is looking at a SPLOST that could generate funds for as long as 20 years into the future. Now, the legislature could come up with a mechanism. One of the things they're looking at is how we create some sort of new authority that will be inter-county, that will help coordinate expansion of transit, even as counties themselves pitch in with SPLOST money to do it, right?
Yeah, and look, we've been talking about this for, over a decade. It's just now it looks like the stars and the moon are lining up. And plus, I think that you're going to see in Washington a big emphasis on infrastructure funding. And that is also going to be a potential revenue source.
All right, we're going to watch that. Go ahead, Beth.
Just a couple of thoughts. One, this is where I think we're going to feel the departure of Keith Parker from MARTA, because Keith, as general manager, has done an outstanding job of running the agency, and I think that's helped bring some players to the table who might not have come otherwise. The second thought is that this will be a major test of our new mayor, of Mayor Bottoms. Primarily because in Mayor Reed, we had somebody who had relationships with the legislature, certainly with the governor, and this will be a test for her that all of us will be rooting for her to pass with flying colors.
I did want to give a shout out to Gwinnett County Commission Chair Charlotte Nash, under whose leadership my home county is taking a very serious look at transit and going out and hearing from the folks about what the needs and wants might be. But I think that's a process where they're sort of on a listening tour through 18 and still years before breaking ground on anything.
All right, those are going to be a couple of the big issues. We're also going to see our religious liberty make a reappearance, as we've discussed. We're going to get into more specifics on the legislature as we move toward the Monday show. Before we move past that, though, is there any one piece of legislation you think that we haven't talked about that maybe we're not thinking about, Todd? I'm putting you on the spot, I know.
I just did a list of this earlier. I think one thing we're going to be hearing a lot about, I know there's at least two pieces of legislation, Representative Darshan Kendrick and Senator Elena Parent, expanding the sexual harassment, sexual assault statutes. And I think that's going to be, whether we're talking about legislation or allegations, that's going to be something that takes up a lot of, generates a lot of hot air.
And another, one other quick one, Eric Tannenblatt, because you mentioned Elena Parent. Elena Parent is also partnering with Mary Margaret Oliver, because they are looking at an opportunity to give local municipalities back the power to deal with Confederate images, markers, memorials, which now the state can decide the fate of. That's going to be an issue that will cause some big explosions, I would think, under the Gold Dome.
Yeah, although I think that this is going to be a relatively short session because of the election year and qualifying. I also think that I would look for some things that will sort of tie a bow around Governor Deal's legacy. This is his last year. I think by all accounts, people think he's been a very good governor. There are some initiatives of his in criminal justice reform and education that I think there's probably some things that he's going to want to see done
before he leaves.
No, I don't know.
Okay.
I'm just thinking of things that he has really led on. Those things stand out to me, as well as economic development. And so I would think that there may be some things that, that he would like to see done before he leaves office.
All right, let's do this. Let's get another break out of the way. We've got a lot more to talk about, including what appears to be a blockbuster story about Steve Bannon comments about President Trump, the people around President Trump, including his son, Don Jr. We'll get to that in a little while on Political Rewind. It's developing even as we're on the air, but let's take a break.
On the next Fresh Air, as President Trump pulls out of treaties and cuts back on UN spending under the banners of America First and Make America Great Again, we'll talk about how China is trying to make China great again and using President Trump to its advantage. Our guest will be Evan Osnos, who writes about this in the current New Yorker. Join us.
Fresh Air is 3 o'clock this afternoon here on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Let me give you all a shot at the governor's race before we move on. We got 5 candidates on the Republican side. We've got 2 candidates on the Democratic side. Beth, let me give you a chance to start. We're going to do this very briefly. Tell me how you anticipate the Democratic race for governor between Stacey Evans and Stacey Abrams unfolding in the months ahead, between now and the primaries in May.
All right. Well, first of all, I don't have a candidate in the race, so this is completely objective analysis, as it always is. just for background, we've got 2 former representatives. Each woman resigned her seat in the House in order to run for governor. Representative Stacey Abrams is from the Atlanta area, the Atlanta and DeKalb area, was the minority caucus leader. Representative Stacey Evans is from Cobb County. They're both attorneys. They both have a very similar kind of stories of coming up from hardship, from difficult childhoods, and both succeeding probably beyond what anybody might have expected, given their backgrounds. So they're 2 extremely impressive women. Both are attorneys. The key difference between them is the strategy that each has mapped out. Representative Abrams feels that the ticket to winning in Georgia for a Democrat is to build and to energize and mobilize the progressive coalition. It's going after people of color, as well as white progressives, the similar kind of voters who animated the mayoral campaigns of Kathy Woolard and Vincent Fort, who were easily among the most energized voters in the city back in November of last year. Representative Evans believes that the path for Democrats is to try to revive support among white rural voters and among moderate suburban voters, the voters who have been the suburban voters in particular who have been key in the electoral victories in Virginia and New Jersey last year.
You know, Eric, it those are fascinating strategies. We've said on the show before, it's going to really be interesting to see how this plays out. But when Beth talks about Stacey Evans pinning her hopes, perhaps on those old yellow dog Democrats, some of them rural, when you said it before the show went on the air, President Trump's approval rating is really still strong in the state of Georgia. And much of it comes from the kind of rural areas that Beth suggests Stacey Evans is going to want to tap into to beat Stacey Abrams.
Yeah, and look, I think that, you know, we're still a Republican state. And, you know, if I look back the last 2 or 3 election cycles, you know, months before the election, we're all talking about how this is the year the Democrats are going to take over. I just don't see it. I think President Trump is still very supportive, has a lot of support in this state. While there are other states in the Midwest and maybe the Northeast where he's lost some of his support, states that he won in the election, I think Georgia still is a predominantly conservative Democrat, Republican state.
Oh, and, I'll take Democrat.
No, Republican state. And look, we dominate both chambers of the legislature, the congressional delegation, and I think you're going to see in this election, the Democrats, you know, may make some gains, but I think it's going to be really hard for a Democrat
to win. So who's going to be the Democratic nominee, Todd Ream, when you think of those 2 strategies? I know you're not going to... Go ahead.
I'll tell you what I think.
Wait, let me... we got a problem with your mic. Go ahead.
I think that if I had to put money on it today, I would bet on Stacey Abrams. And one of the challenges I think for Stacey Evans relates to temperament. Both of those women are very bright. Both of them very collaborative workers. But some of the folks backing Stacey Abrams, who appear to be backing Stacey Abrams, have been very confrontational towards Stacey Evans, shutting her down at Netroots Nation. And I expect she's going to have to make a decision at some point. I think that Stacey Evans is going to have to make a decision of, is she going to confront the folks who don't want to hear from her? And how does that work within the context of a party primary?
Yeah, can she get tough?
Exactly. And how do you do that?
All right, let's look at the Republican side. Oh, go ahead. You want to make one last comment?
One last comment. I would tend to agree with Eric that it's more likely that we continue under Republican governor come January of next year. But the Trump impact is not potentially not as great as it might be in Georgia this year, because we don't have a U.S. Senate race on the ballot, and we'll probably only have a couple of seriously contested congressional races. So the partisans on both sides who are brought out by national elections may not be as likely to be voting coming out to vote for governor. And in an atmosphere where Democrats are just supercharged and just cannot get to the polls fast enough, you've got the potential. It's slight,
right,
but the potential.
The beauty is we have weeks and weeks to continue this conversation. Real quick, Todd Rehm, the Republican side of this thing. Lieutenant Governor Casey Cagle raises the money. He is better known than any of the other candidates. Is he the odds-on favorite to win this thing?
I would say, and I said this earlier at a Republican lunch I spoke to, that I think if you're talking seriously, you have to say he's the front runner. But we've also entered an era of politics where politicians, established politicians, respected people can crater in a way that is unprecedented. And I think any of the top tier candidates are susceptible to that. And so you can have a shakeup of that dynamic at any given moment in the next 9 months.
Eric, where's the business community going to put its money in this race? You're very in touch with the leadership there on the Republican side.
Well, I think that the top-tier candidates are the ones that probably have most of the support. Yeah,
Brian Kemp, Secretary of State.
Casey Cagle. Yeah,
because
they know him, and they view those two as probably the most likely nominees.
Okay, but we also have the wild cards. Michael Williams running a Trump-style campaign.
Yeah, I don't think the business community is lining up.
All right, we got a lot of more time. We're going to move on because we're going to be talking about the governor's race an awful lot in 2018. As we will about President Trump, we try not to lead all of our shows here talking about what's going on in the Trump White House, because after all, we're a Georgia show and we want to make sure we're telling our listeners about what's happening in our state. But every now and then when we start this program, we say to ourselves, oh my gosh, what's happened today in Trump's land, we've got to talk about. So we've disciplined ourselves, but we have two big stories today. And Eric, I'm going to turn to you first on this one. President Trump has exchanged tweets, or he has tweeted back to the North Koreans that even though Kim Jong-un said yesterday that he has a button, a red button on his desk, Trump has a bigger one, and it works, and it's more powerful. Is this how we want to play out nuclear diplomacy?
Well, no, and it's got a lot of foreign policy, people that are involved in foreign policy very, very alarmed, because they don't think that you should be throwing things like that out. However, there are a lot of people that want their president to be tough on, North Korea. And so, you have people that probably listened, saw Donald Trump's tweet and were pleased to see that he's being aggressive. So, it's who is he playing to? I think the thing that is comforting to me is that he is surrounded by people like Secretary Mattis and Secretary Tillerson and Vice President Pence.
Yeah, but Kim Jong-un isn't surrounded by people like that. And it's a question of how he chooses to respond to that kind of attack.
Correct. But I think that that's more bluster than... Then he's actually going to, I don't think he's going to actually.
But he has been surrounded by people like that for the past year. And yet we still have this measure of recklessness and unpredictability coming out of this White House that with today's tweet, when I read that, I didn't know whether to just go, oh, no, here he goes again, or have we hit another low? I mean, that this is 2-3-year-olds. My button is bigger than your button.
But I don't know why, Beth, you or anyone else thinks that Donald Trump one day is going to wake up and be a completely changed
man and
be very disciplined.
I don't. But I mean, I don't know why you or anyone else thinks that there's anybody around him who can control this lack of discipline and who can control this recklessness.
I'm not saying control his lack of his tweets. Clearly, no one can control his tweets. But what I said is that I'm comforted by the fact that the people that he's looking to help him make the actual decisions are people that I think are level-headed and can be trusted.
I hope your confidence in him turning to people for help with these decisions is well-placed.
Todd?
I'm pretty sure that the White House staff has ensured that the only red button on his desk is the one that calls for a new Diet Coke.
You know, that is a wonderful story. Time Magazine did that story a while back. He literally does have a red button on his desk and gets a Diet Coke when he
There's a great story in today's New York Times that there is no button, by the way. There's a code that the president carries around with him.
But, you know, if you can set aside the existential nuclear dread for a moment, there are a lot of folks who feel that the United States has just rolled over for everything that anybody wants, and that the time is ripe for something more muscular and confrontational. Not necessarily the president's tweets, but a more in-your-face approach to the United Nations, to the locations of our embassies, and to dealing with North Korea. And, you know, obviously I think the tweet itself is a little bit further than I would have gone. But giving the way we've approached North Korea over the last however many years has not worked to stem their nuclear program. And something a different approach, I think, is called for, maybe not quite as bombastic.
I don't disagree, but we didn't have to immediately go to the extreme that we have gone to. There are a lot of gradations between where we were and my button's bigger than your button that could have projected strength.
Let's just say this. One of the other things we're saying today is that throughout 2018, we're going to be paying attention to the president's Twitter handle account, and he will no doubt continue to give us fodder for good conversation. Eric, before we get to this other Trump story, the Bannon story, we really don't want to miss an opportunity to talk about the retirement announcement of Orrin Hatch, a Republican senator from Utah, one of Trump's closest friends in Washington, I think, certainly on Capitol Hill. And it opens the door for your friend and associate Mitt Romney to make a race in Utah, which could be President Trump's worst nightmare. Is Mitt Romney going to run? Have you talked to him?
I have not talked to him. I hope he runs. I think he would be a great United States senator, and I think he'd be a great voice of reason in the Senate. And I think that I've read reports that President Trump called him a week or so ago after Steve Bannon, you know, went off on him after that Roy Moore campaign rally. And so I think the president and Mitt Romney probably get along better than the media wants to lead you to believe.
Well, wait. Reality check here.
No, I'm not saying that.
Mitt Romney, certainly during the campaign, was one of the most severe critics, public critics,
absolutely,
of Donald Trump.
But then after the election, Mitt Romney was under consideration for Secretary of State, had several meetings with President Trump.
You're right.
And so, Mitt Romney is a person of, you know, high moral ground. He speaks his mind when he feels strongly about something. He's very principled. When he disagrees with the president, since he's been president, he's been very vocal about it. But I'm just saying that, you know, Mitt Romney, I think he has a a cordial relationship with the president. I don't think it's hostile.
Over the next couple of weeks, the tea leaves I'll be looking at to get any indication of what Governor Romney might be doing is where Eric Tannenblatt checks in on Facebook and Twitter.
And
if I see him posting from Utah and it's not Sundance,
that's exactly what I was
think
thinking.
If Mitt Romney does run, it's going to be a Utah-based campaign. It's not going to be a national campaign. I would not imagine you're going to have people from all over the country piling in.
Why?
Because I think he's running to represent the people of Utah. I think Orrin Hatch has been an incredible senator for the people of Utah the last 40 years. He's going to have big shoes to fill. I think Mitt's very popular in Utah, but I think Mitt's the kind of person that he's going to want to prove to the citizens of Utah that if he goes to the United States Senate, he's going there to represent them.
Beth, if
I don't want to spook Governor Romney or his chances by expressing my fervent desire that he gets into this race, but I think that there are a lot of people around the country that are looking for reasonable, decent, honorable people like Mitt Romney to step up and show some leadership.
Well, and of course, presumably, Todd Rehm, Romney is a Republican who the president cannot count on for votes on any issue he wants him on. And with the Senate divided, at least to this point, 51-49, we're going to see a change in 2018. Nevertheless, it's going to still be close.
If you look to that op-ed we were talking about earlier that written by Senator Perdue, I think a lot of the things that Perdue was saying he likes that Trump did are the kinds of things that a Senator Romney or somebody like him could support. A lot of the pro-business stuff, the tax reform. I think that any member of the Senate, I hope, takes each proposal as it comes on its merits rather than saying I like or dislike the guy that holds that office.
And keep in mind, too, that Mitt Romney was the governor of Massachusetts, which is a predominantly Democratic state, and had to work across the aisle, worked with Ted Kennedy on health care reform. So he's demonstrated he has the ability to work with the other side. His VP running mate is Paul Ryan, who's the Speaker of the House. There are issues we've witnessed between the House and the Senate in trying to reconcile things that he could be a real broker in helping to bring Democrats, Republicans, working with the White House. So I think he could end up being a real leader.
All right. With a couple minutes we have left, let's turn to the news. By the way, we know Steve Bannon will probably lick his chops to try to go to Utah and fight Mitt Romney in that state. And speaking of Steve Bannon, there's a new book that's about to be released. The Guardian newspaper had excerpts from it today. They were able to get an advanced copy of it. It's a book written by Michael Wolff, presumably a friend of President Trump's, who was given pretty free rein to wander through the halls of the West Wing in the early stages of the presidency. And he has an extended interview with Bannon in the book. And Bannon takes apart Donald Trump Jr. We know they didn't get, he and Ivanka and Don Jr. and her husband never got along with Bannon. But he says that the meeting that Trump Jr. had with the Russians to talk about potential dirt on Hillary Clinton was treasonous, unpatriotic. And he says that anybody who thinks the federal prosecutors are finished are going to soon realize that they're going to, quote, crack Dan Jr. like an egg on national television. He also says to Michael Wolff, Bannon does, that he finds it hard to believe that after the meeting the Russians had with Don Jr., that Don Jr. didn't take them to see Canada Trump. That's obvious speculation, but this thing is hit. The White House is really up in arms about it, and the president has already responded and essentially said Bannon has lost his mind.
Yeah, he did. When he left the White House, he lost his mind, and he also said that he doesn't have the influence that he claims. And I think what you're seeing here is don't go after the family, and that's off limits. And he went after Don Jr., his son, and I think this is a big blow for Steve Bannon, and I actually think that this is going to be a good thing because I don't think his influence has been very helpful.
What do we, Todd? One of the reasons I held off this story until late in the show is you can never, it's kind of like a Trump tweet. You don't know what to make of this stuff. We can't figure out the shifting kind of games that the Bannons and Trumps, and they all play with each other. Next week, Bannon and Trump will be holding hands in a restaurant talking about politics in a different way. I don't understand this.
I'll tell you, it is not entirely inconceivable to me that the president and Steve Bannon are texting each other back and forth saying, hey, wait for this next one. I'm really going to zing you good.
It's really bizarre.
It's not impossible. And Bannon has shown himself to be a master of promotion and a master of self-promotion. And I would suspect that Breitbart.com is getting more hits today than it has.
Beth, in the meantime, we're all left just mouths agape,
shaking our heads that these two masters of self-promotion are at the forefront of the news. One of them is the putative leader of the free world, and we're sitting here watching them call each other names and talk about, well, this one's dead to me, and this one's son is going to be cracked open like an egg. It's, you know, in that context, I guess I kind of like my button's bigger than your button tweet. That's the most reasonable thing that's come out of the White House today.
Well, and then we may see the resurrection or return of the mooch.
Excuse me. That got me coughing. Peter Alexander of NBC says that he's the one who says that he thinks that Bannon thinks that Trump Jr. took the Russians up to meet his father. But New York Magazine, this is what I wanted to get to. New York Magazine, from the same book by Michael Wolff, says Donald Trump didn't want to be president. Shortly after 8 p.m. on election night, when the unexpected trend that Trump might actually win seemed confirmed, Don Jr. told a friend that his father looked as if he'd seen a ghost. Melania was in tears and not of joy. There was, in the space of little more than an hour, in Steve Bannon's not unamused observation, a befuddled Trump morphing into a disbelieving Trump and then into a horrified Trump. And then the final moment was when Trump recognized this was his destiny, essentially.
Now you know how Democrats felt the entire evening of
All right.
November 8th, 2016.
Well, look, this story is going to play out, and we will make of it what we can as it unfolds. We're almost completely out of time on today's show. Our first of the new year, Eric Tannenblatt, Beth Shapiro, Todd Rehm, thank you for being with us. Again, we want to remind you that a week from Friday, January 12th, we'll be moving to 2 from our 3 o'clock time slot, and we hope you'll make that move right along with us. Quick programming note on another subject. Tomorrow on Two-Way Street, I hope you will find the interview that we have with retired astronaut Scott Kelly, who has spent more consecutive days in space than any other American, a year on the International Space Station, to be as interesting as we found it when we had him in the studio. We hope you'll join us for Two-Way Street at 2.
I don't want contributions from UGA alumni to dry up. Let's not forget to congratulate the University of Georgia
Bulldogs. I'm not a big football fan, but oh my gosh, it was one of the most exciting games I've ever seen in my life. I'm sure you all agree. That's it for us on Two-Way Street on Political Rewind. We'll see you tomorrow for Two-Way Street.